evening, everyone. This is Gordon, W2TTT. This is the Bergen Amateur Radio Association Technical Net. This net meets weekly on the Chestnut Ridge Radio Club repeater, 146955, in Alpine, New Jersey. PL is 1413, and that's 4A, or 1413 as I said before. And any amateur who's licensed to operate in the 2-meter band in the United States is welcome to participate. This is a different kind of net than most other nets you operate. We want you to check in whether or not you think you have something to contribute, because your presence will help add texture to the dialogue, to the conversation, if you will, among us all. You can talk about pretty much anything you want, as long as it's related to amateur radio, electronics, electricity, telecommunications, computers, things that use those things. Obviously, you know, emergency preparedness, all things amateur radio, all things communications, all things electrical, electronic. So it's kind of cool. So we hope you'll participate. We check in an orderly way, and that orderly way is by call sign group, and we ask you to check in with your call sign, your name, and then indicate whether you have a question, comment, both, or none of the above. So, let's begin and see where we go. Stations whose call sign begin with the letter Kilo 2, please call K2BAR with your call sign, your name. Indicate whether you have a question, comments, both, or none of the above. Please call K2BAR. Over. Okay, no Kilo 2s. Other kilos. Howie Kazawi. Let's try whiskeys. How about Novembers? I'm wondering if my timeliness tonight has upset everybody. Got here on time. Okay. Any stations wishing to check into the Bergen Amateur Radio Association Technical Net, please call K2BAR.
AA2NI, Nico, no questions, no comments, none of the above.
I got you, Nico. There's another station underneath you. Who is that?
This is W2JEK. Don, no questions or comments. Maybe you do have a comment, yeah.
I have to say, if you don't have a comment tonight, I'd give up. Very good, Don. Any other stations? Wowie Kazawi. Two check-ins at 4 minutes after the hour. All right. Anybody else in the Bergen Amateur Radio Association Technical Net? Wow, I got here on time tonight. I set everything up. The well's probably still working. Alrighty. Well, Don, why don't you go ahead with your announcement? And, worst cases, we'll make reference to it later when more people show up. W2JEK, K2BAR.
Hi, K2. And then that W2JEK, getting everybody, Gordon, Nico, and whoever else is listening there. Yeah, well, I'm just reminding everybody that we're having a test session at the Hamfest that's coming Saturday. We'll start at 8 o'clock, and we're going to close the doors at 10 o'clock. So that's the game plan. And reminding people to, this is the one of the last test sessions we'll be holding. We have one more in June before the summer comes along and the school closes. And remind people that are looking for general licenses and studying for general licenses that they have to get a test taken before the end of June, because the question pool will change as of July 1st. So that's that's coming down the road. So hopefully people who are studying will put their thinking caps on and otherwise you're going to have to go out and buy a whole new book and do a whole lot more studying. And June 17th is this Friday in June. We'll have the last actual test session. Then I'll have to make arrangements for September and another month later on. I have to get those dates cleared through K2ZO. Back to net, W2JK.
Very good. Anybody else checking into the net tonight?
This is NS2K.
Most excellent.
Oh dear.
Mr. Jim, go right ahead. Say a few words.
Ah yes, welcome to the cell phone. yeah, not a whole lot this evening. Just want to say hello and getting psyched up for Saturday morning. That should be good. I'll be there at 5 o'clock or just a very few minutes after. And looking forward to a beautiful and very, very warm day. Welcome to summer. Yeah, hopefully we don't have any of those twisty things around here. MS2K.
Don't be so sure. We've had some to the south, and for the first time, I mean the south, like in Pennsylvania, and for the first time in decades, they had one south and east of San Francisco. Go figure that.
Yeah, I was looking at the sky this afternoon, looking out the office window, and it was this very strange gray. And so I checked the internet, and sure enough, there were storm warnings just to the west of us. North and west. Very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw that. By the way, a couple of nights ago, I noticed a really nice front that was hanging north-south, just inland of the coast, maybe 100 miles. And it just looked to me like an opportunity for ducting, and sure enough, there were all sorts of signals popping on 2 meters and 6 meters, tropospheric stuff. So that was kind of neat. That was very, very neat. I didn't work much because I was too busy, but I did see it on the weather map. And this is that wonderful season. So I'm going to give everybody a quiz. What weather conditions cause, increased tornadic conditions in Tornado Alley? Does anybody know? Okay. Warning everybody, political correctness need not apply. The nominal amount of warm, moist air coming out of the Gulf, as it always does, across Texas and Louisiana, places like that, goes into the midsection and meets cooler than normal weather coming from the Pacific. And that's what we have right now. We have more cool weather, cool, moist weather, I'll point out in some cases, coming from the northwest off the Pacific right into the country's midland. So cold and wet meets warm and wet, and we go spinny, and it's time to duck and roll. Okay, now that we've had our little counterintuitive, politically incorrect weather lesson, these formations also happen, as I alluded to before, along the coast, and you get the warm and the cold mixing in stratified ways. They form a nice reflective layer, and if they set up along a distance, they can literally provide a trough. Here it's a weather trough, but it's also a communications trough. Imagine a long building with a curved roof, and if you yell from one end of the building to the other, the curved roof conducts your sound from one end of the building to the other. That's pretty much what's happening with RF in these cases. Comments, anyone? You guys are killing me. Mostly you'll see this stuff on 6 meters, 2 meters, 220, 432. Sometimes higher frequencies as well. Are there any other check-ins for the net? Let's talk about Saturday's Hamfest.
KF2ID, Ben.
Hi, Ben. Good evening. Welcome aboard. Any questions or comments for the net?
Yes, I have a question. Thank you.
Excellent. We'll get to your question momentarily. Any other check-ins for the net? Alrighty. So the announcement for tonight is that Barra is having its Hamfest at Westwood High School in Washington Township. I believe sellers, they can kind of roll into the parking lot sometime around 6. They don't know what time it is for buyers. I want to say it's 7 or 7:30 or 8, something like that. But you can go to barra.org, B-A-R-A.org, and Hamfest is prominently listed on the front page. And that's okay. Maybe you know what time the Hamfest opens for sellers and buyers.
Not really. The buyers are pretty much, it's after 7. 8 o'clock, typically, most people. But, I don't know, Mr. Zeto, he's about, would certainly know, because he's been having to tell a lot of people. But as long as not too many people show up before 5 o'clock is when I'm going to show up, and hopefully ready to take people's money. I've got... I was a little bit optimistic this year. I printed 100 vendor passes. if only we needed that many. And it's too cake.
We do need that many, but the problem is they all get sold. I will be buying one at, I think, $15, right?
$15 gets you the vendor place plus one person.
K2BAR, KC2OR.
Hello there, Robert. Welcome aboard.
Gordon, welcome. Hello, Jim. Gordon, I'm just coming out of Marlow from the Civil Air Patrol meeting, so I'm just going to listen tonight. I'm just going to concentrate on driving home, and I'll see you guys Saturday morning bright and early in Westwood.
Most excellent. Looking forward to it. Okie doke. I've logged you in, Robert. So Westwood High School is in Washington Township on Ridgewood Road. Please note that's not Ridgewood Avenue. Talk in is 014679. So that's the other thing you can think about. And I guess all things considered, that's pretty much what we've got going here. Anyway, we're looking forward to the whole adventure. Let's see, what else? Any other check-ins, and I want to get to Ben's question. Comment?
W2JEK, the time of the Hamfest depends on, I have a friend that goes to a Hamfest with a flashlight. He gets there before the sun comes up when the vendors are unloading their vehicles, and he catches the bargains that way. So, if that could happen here too, maybe, I don't know, our Hamfest. But it's one of the techniques of getting bargains. Back to that W2JK.
Well, it most certainly happens that way. In fact, there are guys who have a very efficient unpacking operation who are vendors. So they pull in, set up their tables, blank, empty, and then go around and watch everybody else unpack and do that. Then when they're getting around to it, they'll finally set up their stuff. It's amazing. Absolutely. Any other observations about the Hamfest? One more time, Don. What time is the test session start? The door is closing for testing. No testing starting after 10?
That's all right, Roger. We're starting at 8, and we close the doors at 10. Figure that's to be ample time window for anybody that's involved wants to take a test. I know some people come through with the last, you know, oh, they got the testing. Oh, I'll try testing. They haven't studied for the thing, and they come in and, you know, they just waste their time and ours and throw $15 away. But that's their problem.
It gives them good context and kind of dejitters them, though, a little bit. All right, very good. KF2ID, your question, Mr. Ben. KTBAR.
Okay, well, first to answer the question that somebody else raised, I got onto the page, and the officially vendors opens for 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. For buyers. And I can read a bunch of other stuff, too, but I don't think it's necessary. Just go to the page and see it. My question. My 7000 has given me a problem. The problem was there for a while, I guess. I've been kidding myself. The power turns down on HF, not on VHF. I can't get more than 25 watts, and that's right into a dummy load. if I set the full power output, it shuts off automatically. To do that, you know, that's a problem. It arose. I certainly knew that when I got it. And if I take it down to 50%, then it turns itself down to 25 watts. And that's the maximum I can get out of on HF at any band. So it sounds like a problem with the unit itself, because that's directly into a very good dummy mode. Measure the dummy load, the ohm meter, you know, went through the whole thing. And so I'm sure the problem lies within the unit. Let me drop out for a moment. Now, I know, I was just wondering where to send it to repair. Now, ICOM has their repair units. I don't know if anybody has any experience with it. And there are independent repair facilities. People who do this for a living more. And so I'd like to know what would be the best place to send this thing for repair, KF2ID.
Okay, I think the first thing I'd like to know is when you key down CW, what's the voltage on your radio?
14.7 volts. I have a 40 amp power supply. I've changed power supplies, and so I have a switching power supply with a peak output of 40 amps, and the voltmeter stands there rock solid when I key it down, so that's not the problem.
What about the connector, and what about the inline fuse?
Fuse? If the fuse was out, it wouldn't work. I don't understand the question about the fuse. But the connector is good. I tried two different cables.
I see. Can you bring your radio with you with an Anderson power pole with some cable on it on Saturday.
Well, I can bring my radio and the power supply on a Saturday. You don't have one of those power pole connectors on. I use, unfortunately I never got to that, I use the automobile connectors, type connectors, which are found to be very, very solid. But I can certainly bring my own power supply, but then we'd have to find some place to plug it in.
I was asking because I have a boost regulator that's wired up for exactly this reason. Because mine has low power output unless I make darn sure there's no sag. And occasionally there's sag, so it is of concern. Has anyone else, I mean, Jim, you have a 7000 as well. What have you seen?
Yeah, I know both the 7000 and the 706 are very sensitive to voltage. But I'm trying to think, it seems like there may have been a problem with the driver or something at one time. And I don't think it was necessarily broken. That is to say, none of the components were broken, but there was a connection, thermal connection, something of that nature that may needed to be corrected, that it wouldn't allow it to run at full zot. But yeah, it's a classic problem with a lot of those ICOMs that it really, really needs full voltage or can't do full output. And it's 2K.
Yeah. You know, there's a Yahoo group called IC7000. No dash, just IC7000. I'd sign up for that list and put that question out on the list.
That's a good suggestion, but I tried this with some power supplies, which, in the past, have run. In other words, this is a new problem. And I had another power supply which I used, that is for several years. I've used that power supply for several years, and then I switched to this other power supply because I thought that was might have been the problem. Maybe the power supply aged or something, and it didn't do the job. That was a somewhat lower voltage power supply, so that was made me think that was a problem. So I don't think it's a power supply problem. This switching power supply certainly ought to handle it. However, I will go to that IC7000. However, my original question still remains. Anybody has any experience with the service performance of the ICOM Corporation? Or anybody has any suggestions for other service providers in case it ends up that Billy has to do something? If it's a thermal problem in the unit, then it certainly has to be serviced. I'm not going to take this thing apart and change anything. It's KF2ID.
Yeah, I didn't lose sight of your original question, and what I was going to suggest was that on the IC7000 archive, there's another one called ICOM as well, by the way. Both have, in their message archives, you can search their message archives looking for service, and there's lots of comments about some really dependable service, factory authorized service people, in a variety of places, who are, ICOM factory authorized, some people are even retired ICOM employees. So, that's one thing you can find in the message archive. If you don't, then what I would recommend is just simply putting a new question out there, and we'll get the usual cavalcade of a half a dozen or a dozen messages from everybody's, basically everybody, referencing their favorite folks, but, there are a number of them who are very good almost all that respond, or that I should say that are referenced by responses, are reputable and good.
That's 2K.
Good, Jim.
You know, I've been lucky enough never having to had an ICOM thing break, so I can't say anything from direct experience. One of the things that I might do is ask Gene KGI. It's obviously he's been in the middle of a whole lot of people's problems over the years, and he may have a suggestion about a local contact or to just, you know, whether or not you should attempt to do anybody locally or just say the heck with it and go directly back to ICOM. NS2K.
You know, Henry, who works for him, that's another good one. I'm sorry I didn't think of that before. Henry, who works for him, is excellent. And you save yourself all the shipping hassle.
He is good.
That there might be your other answer, Ben, over.
Okay, I assume KJI is going to be at the Hamfest tomorrow. So when I did intend to ask him, as you mentioned it, but it reminded me, but I didn't intend to ask him at the Hamfest, so I will. I was wondering if anybody who were listening in tonight might have any favorite repair persons. Okay, well, thank you for your suggestions in any case, and we turn it back to Net Control. This is KF2ID.
W2JEK with a question.
Very good, Ben. Thank you. And Don, go ahead.
Ben, I was just wondering, have you ever tried connecting your rig to the dummy load through an SWR meter and reading the SWR to make sure the dummy load itself was good?
The ICON has an SWR meter built right into it, and it shows the load as being good. And in addition, I have used this load through a tuner which has an SWR meter on it, and it shows that it's good. And also, of course, I measure with an ohm meter, and it's 51 ohms to be exact, KF2ID. It's a very high frequency load, so it's not a question of frequency either. It goes up to the gigahertz range, supposedly, KF2ID.
The W2JEK, yeah, okay, that's good. The only thing is that it may be something in the SWR bridge somehow sent, even though it looks good on the SWR. Well, it's good with the SWR and the external tuner there or whatever you were using. So, yeah, I had a thought. I know sometimes the SWR sensing circuit go kaput, but in your case, it looks, unless it could be something like that, but it just shuts it down, so it sets itself down prematurely for some reason. I guess that's what the people at ICOM get paid to fix. Anyway, good luck with the FactorNet, W2JK.
Yeah, and one other thing is, from a metrics viewpoint, I would not trust the front panel for a hard number. I found it to be amazingly good, but I've also heard that with various kinds of loads, it's all over the place. And, some people will even have said the way their radio is set up, it's all over the place, irrespective of load, so you really want to be careful with that as well. What might be a good idea, Mr. Ben, is to insert a power pole pair into, or a pair of pairs, if you will, into your lead so that you actually have the option of using power poles or regular leads, as you were saying. Now, I'm assuming that the connections you're using are those black rubbery things with the energized hot wrapped in in rubber and the return is exposed on the source side. Is that right?
No, it's a connector. It's an automobile connector. I've seen them before. They're black. Oh yeah, that's right. The return is exposed, but when you plug the other end in, the return gets covered. It's a very good. Looks to me a very good connector, and it's very positive. It seems to me to be very positive and very firm vibration, which people call me the power pole connector sometimes subject to. It doesn't bother it, you know, even bouncing around. I think that connector's darn good as far as its capabilities, KF2ID.
Yeah, I've had trouble finding some of them sometimes, but yes, they are very good. And recently I had a reason to need some of those. I was able to locate some, but what I did was I left them in place and then made the other end of the pigtail power poles. That proved to be a wise decision as well. But anyway, no big deal. I have three different automotive shops in my town. On any given month, I think one or two of them never stock it. And the one that does stock it reliably is not very reliable. You know, you could go a month or two between restocking, and they might have only the low current version. Not, you know, something sturdy with, like, number 12 wire coming out of it. Remember, it's molded. It's a molded deal. So it's not particularly field serviceable. That was my only criticism of the connector. As far as Anderson's pulling out, number one, they don't pull out readily unless you don't set the connector right. And number two, i.e. when you're making it, and number two, you can always run a tie wrap through it and across it to make sure that it doesn't unplug. Any comments? Yeah, NS2K. Two comments, apparently. NS2K first.
On measuring output, I would not tend to trust the front panel necessarily. Confirm with another meter, but for a reality check, look, if you have an ammeter on your power supply, it give you an idea of whether the power is really dropping off or what the relative situation is. Obviously, you can do the calculation how much current it should be taking, and you'll get a pretty good idea of what's going on. Oh, what are we up to here? Ooh, 9 amps. You're on VHF. How about that?
You're running 9 amps on your 7000?
No, the 706.
Okay, yeah, because that's, a 50 watt out 2 meter signal, right?
Yeah, something like that.
That's about right. Yeah, little round numbers. I'm pretty sure the 706 was a 50 watt out, not a 100 watt out 2 meter signal. Oh, very good. Let's see. Who was the other comment under Jim?
AA2NI, I'm going to check out. Good evening all, and catch you on Saturday. AA2NI will be clear.
I was going to ask about Dayton, but okay. That was my next question. All right. 7-3, we'll see you on Saturday, Nico. A2NI, W2TTT, K2BAR. Alrighty, anybody else?
N2AL, one question.
Oh, gotcha. One second, Mr. Noel. Welcome aboard. Any more on this subject? Okie doke. Noel, your question, sir. Welcome aboard. N2AL, K2BAR.
got into a discussion yesterday at the Baronet about two products, one called Stable, one called Seafoam, S-T-A-F-O-A-M. I remarked that we were getting the generator ready for the half fest, my generator. I'm going to power a couple of the coffee pots, I guess. And I remarked that I had took the gas that I had sitting there since November, dumped in the car, went and got fresh, and dumped in 1 ounce of Stables for 2.5 gallons of gas. And then I made a remark about when I had last put the generator away, I had dumped in half an ounce of Seafoam with the gas, ran the generator until it ran dry to keep it from clogging up. So the question got started, why would I do that? Well, I belong to the Honda EU 2000 group, and these people are adamant about using Stable on every time you put gas in the generator, and they're really gung-ho on this stuff called Seafoam, because it appears that when you're running these small generators, a little bit of gum out, or a little bit of gumming, I should say, a little bit of gas may turn into gel. When you don't have a fuel pump, you have gravity feed, means the generator is no-go, and it costs you a couple $100 to get it carburetor taken apart and cleaned. So anyways, any comments on that? This is Ed Coolio.
Those are very good things to do, no doubt about it. In fact, I have not done that, but I start my generator every few months, and it seems to be just fine. Well, I haven't started it since winter, so I should probably go do that. Late in the winter, after the snow cleared a little bit in like early March, I got a chance to start my generator, but now I have to go do it again. I'm kind of curious, anybody have any experience with these two fine products?
W2JEK.
Don.
Yeah, in telephone, I work for a phone company. They ran them an hour once a week, and every month they one month they ran them for an 8-hour test. Now we had two big Hercules diesels, each with 140 horsepower, and they synchronized together so that they wouldn't be turning the other one over as a motor, and well, they would synchronize together. We had I think they were each 250 kilowatts or something like that, or 150, I forget just what the amount was. They had 140 horsepower diesel engine with 6-inch bore and 6-inch stroke piston kind of a thing, V8 supercharged, and you had to go through a whole procedure with them, but that's how we did it. I have a thing with my lawnmower. I never, ever drain the gas out of my tank in the lawnmower. And it starts up every spring. I've done this with all of my lawnmowers. Because you don't drain your gas in the from your car when you let it sit a while. And I think that you're putting stale gas into if the gas does get stale and you put it in your car, you're gonna really mess up with the fuel injectors too. Of course, they'll probably be diluted by the good gas if you have a lot in the tank. So, I've never had any problem with that. I think if you were to let the thing run dry, there's still a few droplets in there that are not going to be exposed to air and cause them to gum up. That's my theory on it. Back to that, W2JK.
We posed some interesting things. First of all, anybody else's comments? Okay, well, I honestly think that the differences between an automotive engine and a typical generator engine is that, number one, we tend to turn them over more often. We're not going to go 6 months or a year leaving gas in the carburetor or the injectors. without removing them through serious exercise every few days or weeks. In fact, you'd be surprised if you do leave a car sitting for a few weeks, assuming the battery's good, you might find that it doesn't really want to turn over really nicely initially. Got to get some of that fuel up where it needs to be and kind of clean out the cobwebs, or in this case, the varnish. So that really does happen, Don. Having said that, you know, running stable in your gasoline is never a bad thing.
Mr. William?
Hey, Don.
What they claim is that the Honda, especially in the EU 2000, but also the 3000, is much more sophisticated than your typical lawnmower. The lawnmower engine is much more powerful and designed to run full blast, and they don't care about mileage or how long it lasts. Meanwhile, Honda advertises that you could set one of their engines idling. I forget what it is. I think it's something ridiculously low, 0.24 gallons an hour. You'd have to go look it up on the web, but it's really quite low. I would run a 1,000-watt heater in November with the Honda generator, and it was on pretty much continuously. And 10 hours, and we'd use maybe 2.5 gallons of gas. So it's designed to be super efficient. And I think that's where the difference may be, is that with this high efficiency, high tech, supposedly the, now I'm not an expert on this, supposedly it's got a lot more little tiny orifices than jets. Now, somebody who may know about this is our friend Jim NS2K, because he does have a Honda EU2000. Suggest we ask him.
Mr. Jim?
Well, I did start the thing up the other day, NS2K, in preparation for loaning the thing out. And when it first started, it was, how should I say, not idling quite perfectly. So I let it run for a little bit and, you know, let it thoroughly warm up, shut it down, and went out for something, I don't remember what, came back an hour later, started it right up, and it seemed to be very, very happy at that point, and I put some load on it. It was happy with that. But, yeah, I think it was a matter of getting the stale gas out. I had a kind of a kick out of the big generator that I bring. Had set for several years unused in my garage, and I know they had run the thing dry, but, you know, running it dry doesn't exactly empty the bowl out. There's still gasoline in there, and in that case, it was allowed to turn into whatever shellac or whatever gasoline turns into, the solid residue, and it was in there some kind of good. And I ended up taking the carburetor apart several times before I finally got the last of the goo out of the jet. And once I finally did that, it would behave, it would take load, and so on. But up until then, it was nasty. I finally got it to the point where it would run, it would start, it would run, but you couldn't put load on it. And it took one more time, and then it would take load. But, yeah, it was unhappy with fully dried out gasoline. NS2K.
W2TTT, I was going to save this story, but sort of, you know, covered the point. But my lawnmower, I always run dry every year. And you're right, there's always some little bit of fuel that gets into the carburetor and shellacs up or varnishes up. And I ended up using an abundance of carburetor starter fluid to get my lawnmower to start this year. I spent a good 40 minutes, you know, pulling the air filter off and then
you know, spraying stuff directly in. I was squirting gasoline into it, and it would fire in a second. Whatever I primed it with would fire, and it would run for a couple of seconds and then collapse. So with the engine starting fluid and another 20 minutes worth of that nonsense, it finally ran very nicely and stably, and it's been cutting my grass ever since. So I expect a similar problem with every generator when you haven't run them for a while. All right, anybody else? All righty. Any more questions for this, for the net? All righty, so my other question is, we are, I think the Fairlawn Radio Club's looking for people to help with their parade on Monday. I'll be marketing the Bergenfield Parade. I'm wondering if people are aware of that, and do we know whether or not there's a Fairlawn meeting on Friday?
Not that it proves anything, but I have not heard otherwise.
Yeah, I would think we are. I think Memorial Day is one of the holiday weekends where Friday night's still a viable night of activity down there. So I'll assume they are. So you can always ask about that. And then, what, of course, in June, on the second weekend, we have VHF contest, and on the fourth weekend we have field day. And I've now been told that I will be spending field day weekend in, not with the scouts, not with AM radio, but with my son's hockey team from Thursday night onward in central Pennsylvania. So we've got that little adventure ahead of us. So I will be operating portable from Pennsylvania, there's no doubt about it. So, my other question is, does anybody know where I can get, like, a fairly sizable piece of, let's say, quarter-inch aluminum plate, about the size of of the long window of a full-size van on the side? Okie dokie, off the Bergen Metals. See if I can find something that happens to float in. Alrighty. I put a piece of plexiglass in to replace my my shattered window, which I shattered with the aforementioned lawnmower right after spending 45 minutes, as I say, getting it to start. A couple of weeks back, I sent a rock right through the side window. It's over $1,000 to replace, so right now there's plexiglass there. And I'll be looking to replace it with aluminum and then using that as the entry point with feed-throughs for all the radio antennas going topside. Probably my next project related to the truck. That should be fun. Any other questions for the net?
Okay, I'm just wondering, you have a plastic there now. You're going to be bringing coax through that, or are you trying to use that as some kind of a ground plane with that quarter-inch thick aluminum?
Ah, and there was another station in addition to Don. I got you there, too. So what my goal is to replace the piece of plexiglass with a piece of aluminum that's of the same form factor. So I would use I would pop out the plexiglass and use that as a template to cut and trim the aluminum.
Sounds thing though, you does it, why does it have to, you want a conductor there, is that what you're saying, or are you using that as some kind of a ground plane, that's why you're using aluminum rather than plexiglass?
I'm using it strictly as a ground plane. It's basically a feature ground plane. I'm gonna take bulkhead connectors and bulkhead feature connectors and put terminate the cables from topside on the outside there, and then run jumpers inside nice and neatly. And part of the reason for that is that flexibility. I want to have the ability to bring different antennas in, and every one of those connectors will have a five-sided or a four-sided cover that goes over top of them. So obviously I'm not going to have one that's 3 or 4 feet long, but maybe 12 inches or 10 inches square. I'll have an area that's covered, and I'll be able to remove that cover if I ever need to change the antennas out. But basically the cables will then exit to the rear and then go up onto the roof.
Yeah, I see what you're going. Is there a possibility that you could just put a little piece of aluminum foil on the inside of the window and drill your holes through the plastic?
Well, I could even take if I just wanted electrical bonding, I could take a smaller piece of aluminum, make sure it's bonded to the frame, and just center it somewhere on the plastic and drill through the combination of the plastic and the metal. I could do that, Don. But I want it to be more complete and a little more rugged than what the plastic is affording me right now. And I frankly don't mind losing the window on the street side, pardon me, on the sidewalk side of the vehicle. That'll be fine. That'll provide a little bit of a cool factor, meaning since I won't have a window there, and it's not next to a seat, except in the rear storage area. In fact, it's not even next to an operating position there anymore. So I put the operating position is now in the middle deck, as well as the front operating position where I am right now. So there's everything in the back would just be storage. So for that matter, I could replace both windows with aluminum. I'm not going to do that. I leave the glass on the other side for now. It's fine. But the goal would be just to replace the steel, or replace the plexiglass with a nice robust piece of say quarter inch or 3/16 inch aluminum plate.
Another thought: would the manufacturer have anything like that? I wonder if they have anything like that to people that want to black in the windows for whatever reason.
I looked in the J.C. Whitney catalog and I did an extensive Google search and couldn't find anything. But I will continue to look in that regard. That's actually a good idea. I might even call a Ford truck dealer or something.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. I mean, they have special stuff like that they do. And maybe somebody has a reason for putting in a blocking anything like that, blocking it in. I mean, I've seen vans that don't have any window at all there, but it came that way. But there's a possibility that they would have a thing that would, piece of metal that would fit in there that would suit your needs.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen them on older vans where exactly what you describe exists, but I have not seen them on more. I haven't seen it online, let's put it that way. A window replacement. I even looked for cargo panel, E350s and things like that. It didn't yield anything when I looked last time.
Mr. Jim? Yeah, a quarter strikes me as being very thick for that sort of project. Typically, I think what we'll use is eighth inch. It's a fairly hard aluminum. Or sometimes something closer to 3/16. If we've got a lot of connectors on a narrow panel and we don't want it to be too flexible, some of the work comes out of our shop is pretty gorgeous, where they'll take a thicker piece, and the connectors are not designed to go through the thick piece. They'll mill D cutouts, and then a relieved area where the nuts all fit. Anyways, pretty gorgeous. But it would at that point leave a thicker band above and below the row of connectors. So we're able to get quite a good count of isolated BNC connectors on a single rack unit, 19-inch panel.
Well, I would be more than happy to bring in or hand you a piece of plexiglass that's all drilled and marked, and not even marked out, just drills. Actually, you mark it out as well, and hand it to you. And if you know anybody who needs to have some practice work for their trade, I'd be more than happy to give them a template for their next, non-production product, to stay in shape and training.
Question?
Done.
Exactly how big is this panel gun supposed to be?
Give me 30 seconds. I'll just jump out. I have a tape in my hand. I just go out and measure it. As I got out to measure it, I actually remembered what it was. The longest dimension is 57 inches, and the height is like 23 1/4, and then it tapers back a little bit to like 22 and something. But basically, it's rectangular. So you need a 5-foot piece of metal to start with, about 2 feet wide.
Okay, I know I got something about 2 feet long in my cellar, but it's about 2 feet by 1 foot, maybe. It's obviously not big enough.
Not exactly a scrap.
But yeah, I started with a larger sheet of plexiglass, had the folks at Lowe's cut it down a little bit to 5 by 2. And then what I did was I lined up the bottom edge on the front, on the panel frame, screwed like the center 4 holes along the bottom, drilled to match the holes, and bolted it in place so now it wouldn't move. And then what I did is I carefully marked it with a marker. Once it was in place, I could actually see where it had to go. And I basically scored and snapped, and worked my way around it and just started adding bolt holes. First on the top row and then the bottom row. Or pardon me, first on the top row and then on the ends, and got it all to fit. So anyway, so yeah, I mean, and Jim, you're probably right, the quarter inch is probably a little more robust than I need. 3/16 is fine. I could make a quarter inch work, but 1/8 inch is really, I don't know. Did I say 1/4 inch? I'm sorry, 1/8 inch, 3/16. You said 1/8 inch would be plenty. What were you saying? You were saying 3/16 would be plenty, right?
Yeah, typically 1/8 inch would be more than enough. In some cases where we've relieved too much of the material, normally on a narrow panel, we might run this up to 3/16, but that's unusual.
Okay. And that would be kind of my scenario here. Let me give you something else I encountered recently that's kind of interesting. You guys know I have that aluminum box on top. And, it's got some holes in places for various things. and such. And I keep electrical cables and my antennas inside there, road safety equipment, things like that. And what I've noticed is that I build up a gray, like, soot on everything inside. And I don't know if it's lead, or it wouldn't be lead, but some residue from the fuel, or it seems to be residue from the aluminum as it's worn by the, like aluminum oxide as it's worn by the passing wind, and it accumulates inside and settles on things that might be electrostatically inclined in particular. I mean, it'll obviously settle on the bottom, but it really adheres to all the vinyl that's inside. It's amazing. I wonder if anyone has seen that characteristic before.